and a little bit more robustness. The only thing wrong with this antenna is, I believe if you mounted it on an automobile and then drove at 40 miles an hour, I think the wind would fold it up, if you know what I mean. It's the one thing it wouldn't survive. But other than that, when I used to travel with my automobile every weekend up to Rome Air Development Center near Utica, New York, I was wishing I had a rotatable Yagi on the roof of my station wagon so that as I was holding this long-range 2-meter sideband QSOs from my automobile, I'd be able to aim the antenna at the guy I'm talking to. I thought of all kinds of ways of having a kind of a joystick in the car that as I pushed it forward and reversed, it would be rotating a wheel and aiming the antenna on the roof by way of a speedometer cable. It would be aiming the antenna on the roof in various directions. I'd have to make sure the antenna is aimed parallel to the automobile as they went through the toll booth. Otherwise, it'd be hitting somebody in the eye with the boom of the antenna, if you know what I mean. So that sounded like a fun project. Sounded like a fun project that I dreamed about but never quite pulled off. Let me drop and get a beep. So I'm gonna find that website again and email that to you. I think you have given us your email address once before, but let me get it from you one more time. If it's not on QRZ.com, Jim, KD2BHY. Do you think that would be an interesting project for you? K2RIW in the second hand.
That sounds like fun. I have to update my QRZ page anyway. I'll put it on there in 2 seconds. Yeah, that does sound like a really fun project, Vic, and I'm glad you found it.
Yeah, up to now, I've been telling you that the least expensive high-performance antennas are the coat hanger Yagi antennas that are on the website of Camp Britain, WA5VJB, Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Juliet Bravo. VictorJulietBravo.com. You go to that particular website, and on page 2 or 3, it's got these very nice designs of what I call coat hanger wire Yagi antennas for 2 meters. And so these tape Yagi antennas look to me like a little bit higher in performance. And when it comes to portable operations, where it doesn't have to be taken apart, it automatically folds and automatically unfolds. So that looks like an awful nice way to go. The burglar alarm tape that you talked about, Bob, I think doesn't spring back quite like carpenter's tape, but maybe it does. Let me take a couple of words from Bob on that one. K4, November, Bravo, Charlie. K2RIW, go ahead, Bob.
Dick, I'm sorry. I was talking to somebody else in the room. In fact, I was trying to explain something that you were talking about. What was the question again?
You mentioned that the kind of tape that's used for burglar alarm systems you thought could also be used for this tape element Yagi antenna. In the case of the carpenter's tape, when the pieces of tape are properly mounted and held down with hose clamps, they can be easily folded and you just let go of them and they spring back. Does the kind of tape that's used for burglar alarms, does it have that springiness, or maybe it wouldn't have that quite that characteristic? K4NBC, K2RIW.
No, it doesn't have the springiness. I thought he was talking about using tape measure tape on a PVC pipe for an antenna. And I guess I assumed, it was going to be a pre-cut size pipe, and he was going to, use shears to cut up tape measures with. No, the burglar alarm tape that I was talking about. I don't know if they use it anymore. I haven't seen it in a long time in anybody's windows. But it's quarter inch wide aluminum tape, has an adhesive side to it that goes in windows. So if somebody breaks the window to break in, the tape breaks and sets off the alarm. I had antennas on my front windshield and my rear window made out of that stuff for receive only. And I've used, you know, the adhesive burglar alarm tape in hotel windows. Comes in pretty handy. Ademco made it, and I got a couple rolls of it that I use from time to time, or used to anyway. K2RIW, K4NBC.
I thank you, Bob. That's good information. And that kind of flexible tape that's got to be taped down to hold it the right position. If you're willing to also lay out the PVC pipe to extend the T-connectors out toward the elements, so that now you're laying the tape on top of PVC pipe for the director-driven element and reflector of the antenna, that's a possible way to go. But this original design, which I didn't make clear, it has a PVC piece of pipe for the boom, and in the right places it has T-connectors of PVC pipe to locate the place for the director-driven element and reflector, and maybe two directors. But the carpenter's tape has its own springiness that you mount it near the boom, and it sticks out automatically out in space to make the director and driven element, so to speak. So it's self-supporting. So that makes it a little bit nicer and a little bit more convenient when it comes to self-folding, when you want to put it in the car and you want to take it on a portable operation. So, as I said, this rah-rah website, I'm going to find it, mail it to you, Bob, and probably you could Google the word Rochester Amateur Radio Association, or RARA, and quite possibly you would find it. But as I said, the April issue of their monthly journal has these beautiful articles with websites giving you all the details as to how to build it. Sounds like an awful fun project for people who need higher gain on 2 meters, and we all do. Okay, the next person is on my list is Paul, WS2N. Let's see. I think we should go to the mailbag first. Let's go to the mailbag. Also, I'm going to tell you, John, that I think from your photographs, I think I've got some good news for you. But what kind of questions have we gotten in Mel's Corner in the mailbag this week, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick. One on the net. Okay, start off. We have an equipment question here. Gentleman who's looking to buy an oscilloscope. Okay. And he is interested in the measurement for what they call the rise time. Okay. Now, he's looking to get as much as he can for his money. He has, he'd like to get something 200 megahertz, but 100 megahertz would be fine. That will do his job, but if he can get it for the money, he will. But he wants to know the importance of rise time and what should he look for, and basically as much information as you can give in simple terms on buying his first oscilloscope. That's about it from Greg. Okay, back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yeah, Greg asked a very nice question. When it comes to test equipment that's one step beyond your volt-ohm milliammeter or digital voltmeter, which is really the most basic piece of instrumentation that almost every one of us acquires in the very beginning. A volt-ohm milliammeter allows you to find out, do you have a dead battery? Is the receiver drawing the right amount of current? Is the 110-volt socket in the wall live? I mean, all kinds of basic measurements like that with a digital voltmeter or a old-fashioned volt-ohm milliammeter. And in my day, in your day, John, these used to be called triplet. And all of a sudden, I can't remember the other brand name. What's the other brand name besides triplet, Chuck?
Epson.
And don't forget Weston. I started with Weston, Dick.
Yeah, Weston is the one in the nice mahogany box. Simpson and triplet, model 630, I guess, is the most popular one. 20,000 ohms per volt, 50 microampere Dawson valve meter movement, about 4 inches wide on the front face. And the machine is rugged enough you can drop it quite a few times before you get into a lot of trouble. So that's the most basic thing that we all own, soldering iron, basic tools, you know, needle nose pliers and side cutters and whatever. But when it comes to serious instrumentation, the very next step, the oscilloscope is usually the piece of machinery that will give you the most amount of bang for the dollar and the most amount of beauty on your test bench, if you know what I mean. And so the old days, the very first oscilloscope that I owned, I think was good up to barely one megacycle, barely one megacycle. And it had a Cyrotron oscillator for the horizontal sweep, a really primitive thing made by the Dubot company. Nowadays, the Cadillac of a...
Is that a 241, Dick?
I don't have it anymore, and I don't have a good memory, but that may have been. Don't tell me you still got one of those, John. I guarantee that Mel, K2KEY, probably owned one of those. And so oscilloscopes have come a long way. The Cadillac of oscilloscopes is Tektronix. Tektronix has challenged everybody in making oscilloscopes, with rare exception. Hewlett-Packard tried giving them some competition for a while and couldn't quite hack it as well as Tektronix. So Tektronix pretty soon got up to oscilloscopes that went into the 2, 3, 4, and 500 megacycle bandwidth capability. And so when it comes to how fast and how high a frequency can the oscilloscope respond to, let me drop. They usually give it to you in two separate ways. They either tell you the highest frequency that it will display with, let's say, 5 or 10% of droop in its performance, or they'll tell you the rise time in microseconds, nanoseconds, picoseconds, and whatever. And some of the sampling oscilloscopes, they go down to picoseconds of rise time and fraction of a picosecond of rise time. So that's another whole issue. So a very rough rule of thumb, which is not quite accurate, but it gets you into the ballpark. If somebody tells you the oscilloscope is good for 100 megacycles, and you take the inverse of that number, 1 over 100 megacycles, the exact formula for rise time of the 3 dB bandwidth, if you know the 3 dB bandwidth of any kind of a circuit, whether it be an inductor in a coil, whether it be the bandwidth of the front-end amplifier of your receiver, if somebody tells you the half power bandwidth, which is sometimes called the 3 dB bandwidth, and you fit that into the equation of 0.3 divided by the bandwidth in megacycles. I'll repeat that. Rise time equals 0.3 divided by bandwidth in megacycles, bandwidth in any units. We carry that out and carry out the decimal places correctly, and the answer you get will be some number of microseconds or nanoseconds of rise time. And rise time is usually defined as, if you've got some kind of a perfect square wave generator, that by one means or another you believe it puts out a perfect square wave, where your signal generator generating a square wave has essentially zero rise time to it. It makes a brick wall looking square wave. Then you put that square wave into your properly adjusted, properly compensated times 10 oscilloscope probe, and there's a whole procedure for properly calibrating or properly adjusting the probe on the oscilloscope. When the oscilloscope probe is properly adjusted, and you look at the display on the screen, and you measure the time that goes between 10% rise and 90% rise. In other words, if you wait long enough, the pulse displayed on the screen will go to full amplitude. But if you carefully choose the timing of where the trace on the screen passes 10% of full amplitude and then 90% of full amplitude, and you take the time difference between the 10% and 90% point, that's the usual definition of rise time of an oscilloscope. And it usually fits into the formula of 0.3 divided by bandwidth. And you carry out the right decimal places, and you come out with some number of microseconds or nanoseconds of rise time. So that's a rough rule of thumb of the relationship between the two. The reason why that formula is not quite accurate for an oscilloscope is that a serious person using an oscilloscope doesn't want to measure the half power bandwidth of the oscilloscope. In other words, he's using a signal generator, he's turning the frequency higher and higher, and he's looking at the display on the oscilloscope, and because the vertical amplifiers of the oscilloscope have a certain limitation, bandwidth frequency limitation, eventually the signal displayed on the oscilloscope screen becomes smaller than it should. And so I believe many oscilloscope manufacturers will declare the bandwidth as the place where you still get 90% of amplitude. Well, 90% of amplitude is not the half power bandwidth. half-power bandwidth would be 70% of amplitude. So because of a difference in definition of the frequency response, the formula I gave you is a little bit off, but it gets you into the ballpark. And so now, when it comes to eBay and places like that, I'd like to believe a person can buy a used oscilloscope, and some of these oscilloscopes, the really nice ones, have got two or four channels to them where you can display a number of waveforms on the screen simultaneously because they have separate beams flashing onto that phosphor at the same time. And now you can compare the input waveform to an amplifier that you're testing to the output waveform. And by looking at both of those waveforms displayed on the screen simultaneously, you can see the time delay, the phase shift, the amplitude gain or loss, and whatever. So using an oscilloscope to measure the input, you put one scope probe on the input of your amplifier where you're applying a signal to it, and you put the other scope probe on the output where the... You put the second oscilloscope probe on the output of the amplifier where the loudspeaker or whatever you're using as a load is located, and then by comparing the two on the oscilloscope, you can get a lot of information. And with minor modifications of a good modern-day oscilloscope, with a couple of other doodads that you can build, to build a homebrew time domain reflectometer, where if, for instance, you had a short circuit or an open circuit somewhere in the middle of your transmission line, your coaxial cable going up the tower or going across the ceiling of the basement before it comes out the cellar window, so to speak, and you want to find out where is the fault, a time domain reflectometer, which could be homebrewed and applied to a good oscilloscope, it would give you distance to fault. You would look at the echo coming back from that fault on the cable on the oscilloscope screen, and you'd know where to start looking for the error, so to speak. Well, in the case of a tanker ship that might be 900 feet long, and you got a whole lot of coax cables below deck that go between the bow and the stern, and a piece of cargo on the ship shifted off to one side, slammed up against the wall, and pinched that piece of cable, and that piece of cable now has an error in it, and you want to know where is the error. Using a time domain reflectometer on that ship could save you a tremendous amount of time. You would eventually know exactly what bulkhead to go to in order to find that shifted piece of cargo that damaged that piece of cable, if you know what I mean. I bet you you've done things like that in the past, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Oh, absolutely. That was one of the famous items of the 465, no, with the 545, the old 545 had a pulse generator on it. And all you had to do is put a C connector, terminate the cable at the end, and you could get within the ballpark exactly where the damage was to the cable. Boy, that's gone way back. And if you know that, you have to know the propagation back to the cable too. So if you know the speed of the cable, definitely figure it out. Great item. And I would recommend a 465 Tektronix for it's a dual trace, and it's a very easy scope to work, and they are extremely accurate, and they're plentiful on eBay at reasonable prices. So I think he has a good place to start there.
K2IKT with a comment. K2IKT, recognized. Get you in a second, sir. John, a Tektronix 465. I think I've owned one of those dual trace scopes. I believe it goes to something like 150 or 200 megacycles. And you're saying they're plentiful on the surplus market these days. I am guessing that is roughly a 1985 or 1990 piece of instrumentation. But still, with its slightly old-fashioned real cathode ray tube, which was very rugged, and it's a very well-designed instrument, the fact that it's 20-some-odd years old, it shouldn't bother you. And yes, it's not quite as light and compact as some of these flat-screen, liquid crystal display type handheld oscilloscopes these days, but I have some trouble using the more modern one. The display is a lot more difficult to use and not quite as user-friendly. What's your best guess, John, as to the approximate price a person might be able to buy a used 465 Tektronix oscilloscope for today? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
He could buy that oscilloscope in good working condition, and they usually show you the traces. And those scopes had an excellent life on the CRT. And I would say $300 he should do extremely well. And there's many more models, too. And he could research them on the tech website and see exactly what they can do and make his choices. But I think for $300, he could be well set. And I think that was IKT George that was in.
Go right ahead, George.
Just a quick comment, which is buy an oscilloscope, great. Pick the one you like. And the fair price, certainly the 465 is an excellent choice. Just make sure you get probes with it. And Dick, I don't know if you want to make any comments about probes, but if you don't get the right probes, the signals you're looking at will be overdistorted. So make sure that the scope comes with the correct probes and the probes are in good shape. Back then, it doesn't beat the IKT.
C2YL.
Bernie recognized. Bernie, you might have a point of order, so I'm going to give it to you first. Go right ahead.
Negative. Comment on tech, so just picking up the right time.
Okay. Why don't you give your comments, and I'll give my comments on probes. You got it, Bernie.
I'm going to second what George said, that be very cognizant of probes, that you get a great scope and then just get really feet over the barrel and try the probes. So be very careful with that. I bought a tech scope, bought it off of eBay a couple of years ago. Had a very pleasant experience. My recommendation is you go the eBay way. Get a seller who has thousands of feedbacks. Get a seller who has a number of different scopes for sale. Contact the seller. Talk to them. These are people that basically are used equipment dealers, and they're reputable people because they want a happy customer. And so tell them, you know, if you see a bid, you know, if you see an auction for one that's not quite right what you wanted, contact the seller. Find out when they are selling one that you want. So I would highly recommend that. I would also say make sure you find the manual for your tech scope and read it. I read mine about once a year, and I swear I learn something every time I read it.
Yeah, these modern-day Tektronix oscilloscopes have something on the screen called delayed sweep function, where the main knob that you twist in order to change the timing, where you make it 1 millisecond per centimeter or 1 microsecond per centimeter, and it's a 1:3:5 ratio in between all of those, 1:3:5:10. That knob also has a function where you pull it out and twist the inner knob compared to the outer knob. You can now get a emphasized portion of the display which gets stretched out in time, and therefore it's the equivalent of putting a magnifying glass on a certain portion of the waveform. Very handy function. And so many of the Tektronix scopes have that delayed sweep function. And the first few times that you try to use it and properly synchronize it, it does require a bit of a learning curve, and so reading the manual on how to do that would be very helpful. So getting a hold of the manual is important. Let me drop. The wire that goes between the probe and the rest of the oscilloscope really is a small piece of coaxial cable. 50 ohm, 90 ohm, 120 ohm, but it's a piece of coaxial cable. It's a shielded piece of cable that's in the vicinity of 3 feet long or so, and that's what goes into the front panel of the oscilloscope. That cable, by definition, has something in the vicinity of 27 picofarad per foot. So that if you just simply made a homebrew scope probe that was a piece of coaxial cable connecting to the front panel of your oscilloscope, and you got two miniature alligator clips on the end of that between the shield and the semiconductor, and you connect that to your circuit, because there was 3 feet of cable there and a 27 picofarad per foot, let me round it off to 30, you would be putting 90 picofarad of capacitive loading on your circuit when you connected that homebrew probe to the circuit that you're measuring. And if you're measuring an audio circuit that's going up to 10 kilohertz, then 90 picofarad of loading would probably be fairly minor, and it wouldn't give you much of a problem. Go up to a megacycle of signal or beyond, and that amount of stray capacitance in your scope probe is going to really violate the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, so to speak. You're going to be disturbing the living daylights out of the circuit that you're measuring. If it's a 1 meg or 100 meg circuit, it might completely stop working because of the capacitive loading that you've created with that homebrew oscilloscope probe that I just described. Let me drop. When you look at the schematic diagram, of a modern-day oscilloscope probe, you'll find out that it really is a resistor-divider network and a capacitor-divider network, which has an adjustment screw at one side. And so a really good scope probe, properly designed for your particular oscilloscope, and there's ways you can modify them if you've got the wrong one. If you've got a Tektronix, if you've got a scope that was made for, if you've got a scope probe that was made for Hewlett-Packard, and you're using it on Tektronix, there's probably a way you can modify it. It's not a showstopper, but know that there is a difference. Each oscilloscope has a different number of picofarads of its wire and a different amount of loading that takes place behind the front panel. But that scope probe usually is a times 10. That's a fancy way of saying it has a 10-to-1 voltage divider function right at the tip of the probe of the scope probe. So the thing that connects to your circuit probably is going to see 1 megohm of loading resistance shunted by something like 7 picofarad of capacitance. That's what the scope probe will do, and maybe the scope probes are a little bit lower in capacitance and maybe a little bit higher in ohms. But the fact that the scope probe has this voltage divider function is both good and bad. Number one, the good news is that it creates very little loading of your circuit. Therefore, the circuit continues to behave as if you haven't connected the scope probe, and that's good news. The second thing it does is that because it is a 10-to-1 divider function, you may see something on the screen that looks like 1 volt signal, but because you're using a times 10 probe, you know to multiply everything you see on the screen by 10, that this real signal is a 10-volt signal, because it went through a 10-to-1 voltage divider network in the oscilloscope probe. One other good piece of information is that some of these scope probes have other little doodads on them, which tells the...
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
It tells the basic instrument, by way of the extra connectors that it connects to the front panel, it tells the instrument that it's using a times 1 or a times 10 scope probe, and therefore the instrument internally readjusts things to take out this 10-to-1 function, and now you can directly read the screen. So, depending on whether or not you're using the scope probe designed for your particular oscilloscope, which automatically informs them of that function, or whether or not you've got to do that mentally, know that that's a factor. Also, most of the really well-made oscilloscopes will have a square wave generator on the front panel, where you take the scope probe, fold it back toward the front panel, connect it to this test point. It generates a square wave signal, and by looking at that square wave signal on the screen, you now can take the adjustment screw mechanism, and there's 2 or 3 different ways that that's done, but there's an adjustment screw usually on the scope probe that when you set it correctly, the beautiful square wave that's generated by the signal generator, which is in the scope, in the oscilloscope and coming out the front panel, that beautiful square wave going through your scope probe and now being displayed on the screen should be a nice square-looking square wave without undershoot, without slant, and without overshoot. As you adjust that compensating adjustment on the oscilloscope probe, you will see the square wave change characteristics, and you want to make the square wave on the screen look right for the probe you're using, and then you know that it is calibrated, you know it's got the right flat frequency response, and now when you connect it to your circuit, you can believe the readings that you're going to get off that screen. So an oscilloscope is a beautiful piece of instrumentation. It gives you a very pretty picture. It gives you tremendous amounts of information. Let me give you an example. If I connected the oscilloscope, I think that's Bob, and I'm going to send it to him in a minute. If I connected the oscilloscope to the speaker output of my ham radio receiver, during the time that I'm getting some raspy, staticky noise, and if I set the oscilloscope so that it internally synchronizes itself to the 60-cycle line frequency, and I set the oscilloscope so that it's got 20 milliseconds of sweep across the screen, a 60-cycle sine wave takes 16 2/3 milliseconds to complete one particular sine wave, 1 over 60 cycles. And so I'm now synchronizing my oscilloscope screen to Con Ed or LIPA power, 60 cycles, and now I look at the audio output of my loudspeaker of my ham radio receiver that's getting the static, And if I see spikes of noise that occur in very characteristic positions on that screen, I know that I'm getting a 60-cycle repetitive waveform, which maybe is the breakdown of a porcelain insulator out in front of my house because of the way the power line has a tree branch that's arcing over to it, if you know what I mean. So that's just give you one example of where properly timing things, the oscilloscope can really give you a lot of additional information about what is the nature of the noise you're seeing on the screen. I think it was Bob, but I'm not sure who wanted to make a further comment. Go right ahead at this time. K2RIW in the TechNet.
And so we go, Dick, with a comment.
Rich recognized, and there was another person.
Okay, I just wanted to add for a quick comment that the triggering circuits in Tektronix scopes work better than the triggering circuits in the Hewlett-Packard scopes of the day, because Tektronix had a lot of the triggering circuits patents locked down, and HP had the design around them. So I just wanted to stick that in there, that as far as scopes go, the Tektronix scopes triggered better. And one of the best scopes that he could ever get is also one of the cheapest scopes you can buy used, the Tektronix 475. There's plenty of them out there. They're dirt cheap, and they'll outlive the owner. Back to you, Dick, K2RIW from K4NBC.
Very fine, Bob. That was Bob from the independent locality of Florida. Thank you, Bob. And yes, when you've got a repetitive waveform being generated by your circuit, you really want the oscilloscope to act like a stroboscope. You want it to make the signal on the screen sit still. That's called triggering. Each time your signal goes through a zero crossing, for instance, you would like this oscilloscope to begin the sweep on each zero crossing of the signal, and therefore you'll get this repetitive signal displayed on the screen in the way where it sits still. If you don't get the right kind of triggering function, then the signal continuously moves across the screen and interpretation becomes a lot more difficult. So triggering is an important function. And Tektronix, as Bob has indicated, has some beautiful signals, triggering circuits where you can choose by pressing buttons and twisting knobs on the front panel of a 455, 465, or 475 Tektronix scope. I think each one of those is a dual-channel scope with just slightly different frequency response. The higher the number, the higher the frequency response. And I think the higher numbers go to 200 or 300 megacycles of frequency response. When you are punching those buttons for the triggering functions, you can make the automatic triggering function be alternating circuit coupled, AC coupled, direct circuit coupled, DC coupled. You can make it coupled with a high pass filter, a low pass filter. You can make it thoroughly automatic. You can tell the triggering function, I want you, the oscilloscope, to use your intelligence and choose the best way to do triggering. In theory, the machine studies the waveform and chooses some characteristic of the waveform, like a fast rising leading edge or a fast falling trailing edge, and it triggers on that and makes the picture sit still on the screen. So there's automatic triggering, AC coupled, DC coupled triggering. There's usually another knob where you can decide on the voltage at which you want the trigger function to operate. You can twist that knob so that it will only trigger on a signal that is greater in magnitude than 3.14 volts, for instance, or more negative than minus 1.4 volts, for instance. So you can make it negative enable, positive enable, DC offset, AC coupled, DC coupled, automatic, and so on. There's a whole lot of triggering functions. And there's an art and science to choosing the right one that'll give you the prettiest display and give you the most amount of information and not miss anything on the screen. In some cases, you're looking for a weird signal that only happens rarely, the so-called probability of intercept problem, and unless you set the oscilloscope triggering just right, you're not going to catch that event, or you're going to catch a zillion other events that are irrelevant, and now the screen is filled up with signals you don't care about, and you're missing the signal you do care about. So properly setting the triggering function can allow you to capture a really wild signal that only happens one chance out of a million, if you know what I mean. Been there, done that. As I said, there's a whole art and science to properly triggering an oscilloscope. N2E...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
N2EO with some further comments. Go right ahead, Rich, K2RIW. How many oscilloscopes have you owned?
Okay, Jake, I'll be copying on my handheld.
Your copy is 40% noise, 60% audio. We can hear you. Please proceed.
What? Chinese food here. I'm downstairs. Yeah, I have a Tektronix downstairs. I forget the model number. It's a modern, it's fairly modern, 50 megacycle, dual trace, trigger switch, Tektronix. Just wanted to comment, I bought probes that were literally Chinese copies, because they were made in China, of the Tektronix probes. The 10 to 1 probes, like you said, they've got the compensating adjustments on them that I was able to do from the front panel of the scope. I got them from Marlon T. Jones Associates, MTJA, in Florida, and they were like $20 a piece. They've got probes that go up to, I believe, 100 megacycles. They're not expensive. They literally copy the Tektronix probes. Back to that, N2EO.
Is that the scope on your workshop desk? KZ2DH1.
Doug recognized. So I think Rich is saying that yes, in his picture on QIZ.com, that is the scope probe that's sitting on his desk. And so scope probes, many companies will have scope probes that become intermittent because the wiring is being bent a whole lot of times, and they get thrown in the garbage. I'm the guy who picks them out of the garbage and repairs them. So I've picked up quite a few scope probes over the years that people have thrown away because they become intermittent. Let's see what kind of scope probes Doug has used, and what's your favorite kind of oscilloscope, Doug? W-H-U-S-A-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick and the gang. This is W-H-U-S-A-Y. I happen to have a 475, and I also have a 465. 475 is an excellent scope, so it's a 465. 465, I think, is 100 megacycles. 100 megacycles. 475 is 200 megacycles. Make that megahertz if you're modern. And I'm looking on eBay right now. I see 475 scopes for anywhere from $149.99. Buy it now with a guarantee to return it if you don't like it. And although I upped it to the almost $500 range, so that's the price range. And yeah, you're right. Most of these scopes, actually, that one for $149 comes with probes, but I have very seldom seen a scope for sale with probes. That's unusual, but if you do get that option, you should certainly take it, because good probes are expensive. So I just wanted to kick in with that information if anybody is interested. I like those Tektronix scopes. I wouldn't have anything else. W-A-2-S-A-Y, back to net.
Very fine, Doug. There's another testimonial for Tektronix. As you guys can tell, Tektronix really is the Cadillac of oscilloscopes, in my opinion. Hewlett-Packard tried very hard. Nicolet and a number of other companies have tried very hard. Inritsu has some pretty nice oscilloscopes with flat screens, but fairly pricey numbers these days. But the fact that the 465 and 475 Tektronix oscilloscope is about 20 years old, don't let that bother you. That machine was very well designed. The worst that can happen is that after 20 years, the main rotary switches that allow, it's a multi-deck rotary switch that allow to select the timing, the horizontal sweep speed, and there's also another set of rotary switches that allows you to select the vertical gain on channel number one or channel number two. In some cases, those rotary switches get slightly noisy in their contacts, and by opening up the cabinet and squirting tuna cleaner in there in those contacts 98% of the time will make everything no longer behave noisy. One of the Tektronix scopes that I had, one of the push buttons on the front panel allowed it to expand the screen by either 5:1 or 10:1. And that that particular push button switch was a little bit scratchy, and occasionally it would go into a mode where the signal would not appear on the screen at all until you press that particular button once or twice. And after putting some tuna cleaner on it, the problem went away. So that's about the worst that happens. It's an extremely rugged... It's an extremely rugged instrument, and in some cases, I believe a Tektronix scope might survive a fall down a flight of stairs and still keep operating. You might get some bent up things on the front panel, but all of that is fixable. And once you own the manual for the machine, a guy like Andy, WATCDL, can fix anything. You, with the right attitude, can fix that. There's almost nothing in that oscilloscope that you can't fix, with one exception. If the cathode grade 2 has failed, I'll admit that repairing that could be pricey and difficult, finding that particular older cathode grade 2. But just about everything else in there, the high voltage power supply, the main power supply, all of the horizontal and vertical sweep circuits and the synchronizing circuits, all of those, none of them contain, you know, platinum-plated parts or whatever. Every individual component in there is, in my opinion, not super expensive and repairable. So a good 465 oscilloscope, I think a modern-day amateur would get a lot of pleasure out of that for the next 20 years. That's an opinion. Yes, it's not quite as light and small and portable as some of the newer ones, but some of the newer ones don't have anywhere near as many buttons on the front panel. They have menus after menus after menus. They have some very funny functions where the user friendliness is nowhere near as nice. In the case of a Tektronix oscilloscope, if you want a synchronization function to change, you grab the synchronization knob. If you want the gain to change, you grab the gain knob. And you can even change the gain in 1, 3, 5, 10 steps, or you can twist the little red knob in the center and twist it in a continuous manner over a 10:1 ratio. If you want to take your particular waveform and force it to sync.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
If you want to take your particular waveform and force it to be exactly 5 boxes high from peak to valley of your waveform on that oscilloscope screen, by twisting that red analog knob in the middle of the main gain knob, you can force easily your waveform to fill up exactly 5 boxes right on the line. And now every other signal that you measure could be measured with that reference, and it becomes very simple mathematics to find out that signal number 2 on the second trace is 10% or 88% of the amplitude of signal number 1, if you know what I mean. So having all of those knobs on the front panel, yes, it makes the front panel a lot more busy, but boy, when it comes to user friendliness, we older guys like that. The fact that the modern-day oscilloscopes have so few knobs on the front panel that you have to find menu after menu after menu, and sometimes you go to menu number 5 and set function number 4, and you go back to menu number 2, and for some crazy reason, the oscilloscope forgets about what you dumped menu number 4, and it forgets that particular function. I've seen a lot of software that does that these days, and it drives you crazy. Having the individual knobs is an awful nice way to go. I bet you you've used some strong, salty language on occasion when some of these modern-day instruments with their zillions of menus have given you grief because they're not as user-friendly. I bet you've learned a little bit of that from time to time, John. KC2WGB, go to the next one if you want, or give us your comments on this one. K2RIW, you got it, John.
Oh, you're right, Dick, about some of the new scopes. I have the newer Tektronix that goes to 500 meg, and they have hard drives in them, and you can remember your settings. But what is nice about it, the later ones have a new button, automatic. You can just connect your probe to the device, hit automatic, it will set your horizontal rate, your vertical amplitude, it'll set it all up for you. So that's pretty sweet. But the 465, the one reason I like that, and I recommend that to somebody starting out, all of the modules are plug-in.
and it has all discrete components, mostly transistors that plug into sockets. A lot of people don't like that, but boy, when you've got to repair something, or if you want to test a few transistors, excellent product. I love it. And that's what I would recommend, and I would not worry about the probes. You can use an HP probe without any problem on the Tektronix scope, or you can buy those ones that Richie said. I bought a few myself. They do work, and the fact that you have that little square wave generator on there, you can set the compensation of the probe, you can check the 1 times 100 or 1 times 10 switch on the probe, and you'll be right on the money, and especially somebody just starting out, you know, they're not going to make traceable measurements anyway, so I don't think you should be scared about that. Let me let it drop. Okay, I have a question on capacitors, if you're ready for this one.
Yeah, we're ready, John, and that's a good point that you made. The fact that the oscilloscope probe has brand X, Y, or Z on it, as long as the price is cheap enough and it's not completely melted down, if you know what I mean, don't be afraid to buy somebody else's scope probe. By way of that calibrator on the front panel of the Tektronix scope, you can immediately find out whether or not the scope probe is working correctly, and that'll immediately give you information about what to change if it's not. So with rare exception, you can use somebody else's scope probe. You may lose the function of automaticness, where the scope probe tells the machine that is times 10 and it knows internally to multiply everything by 10. You may lose that function, but that's an easy one for you to readjust mentally, if you know what I mean. Go right ahead on capacitors, John, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. The 465 doesn't have the automatic probes. It won't sense an automatic probe, but it will work with the automatic probe. It just won't detect that it's there because it doesn't have that feature. All right, let me get to the next page.
Yeah, let me pick up that Doug first. Go right ahead, Doug.
Yeah, hi, Nick. WA2SAY here. I have something to say about probes. Two things. Probes have bandwidth, so if you get a cheap probe and a 100 or a 200 megahertz scope, you may not have the bandwidth anymore. And the other thing is the cheap probes tend to be made cheaply, and they tend to fall apart. So if you're going to buy a probe, instead of spending $25, spend $35 or $40 and get something decent because it'll hold together, whereas a $25 probe probably will not. You'll wind up with something you can throw in the trash can within 6 months. Back to net.
Yeah, good information there, Doug. The probe is the high reliability problem item of an oscilloscope. So try to treat your probe with tender loving care. Try not to do too much sharp bending of the wiring right at the end of the probe or at the portion where the wire goes into the oscilloscope front panel. Try not to bend the wire too much there. Consider putting strain relief, wrapping tape, or putting extra rubber or whatever, because those are the usual points of maximum failure. And so Doug did bring up another good point. Some probes only rated up to, let me pick a number, 20 megacycles. And if you've got a 150 megacycle scope, to connect a 20 megacycle rated probe to it could, in some cases, be a little bit wasteful. But by way of the response you get off of that calibrator on the front panel, you'll find that out pretty fast. So it's not a showstopper, but and if the price is right on a 20 megacycle probe, buy it. It's not going to stop you. You can always buy or make a modification to that probe so that it has a higher frequency response. There's ways of getting around that problem. So don't let that be a showstopper, but know that it is a factor. Know that the right time that you're going to measure from a 20 megacycle rated scope probe is going to be a lot slower than the real rise time of the oscilloscope itself. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Okay, we'll move on to the capacitor question. All right. This young man is trying to figure out the exact way these capacitors are working. He knows they consist basically of two plates and a dielectric. Now, his question is on an air capacitor. You have air, basically, as the dielectric. Now, he's wondering if he were to tune in a radio station with an air variable capacitor, and it was in, I guess he means a bell jar, and he evacuated it. Would that change the frequency? Good question. Back to you, Dick.
The answer is both yes and no. If I had a very precisely tuned, free-running oscillator that used an air variable capacitor inside of a bell jar, and let's assume now that my oscillator is free-running at exactly 10 megacycles, I carefully adjusted it for 10 megacycles. I close the bell jar, I've got the frequency counter running, and I start evacuating the air. And air has a dielectric constant of something like 0. It's either 0003 or 0004. It's got a very small difference in dielectric constant compared to vacuum. Air is a substance, and it does have an effect as a capacitor when it's placed between the plates. As I evacuate the air, and that very tiny amount of dielectric characteristic of the air is now removed, and I wait long enough for those air molecules to finally find their way out of the bell jar and into my vacuum pump, and that takes some time, by the way, I will find out that my 10 megacycle oscillator is now, let me pick a number, 1 kilohertz higher in frequency. So yes, the frequency will shift. And the exact amount of shift, once you find out the exact dielectric constant of air compared to vacuum, you can calculate exactly how much it's going to shift. I just gave you an approximate number, 1 kilohertz out of 10 megacycles. It's in that ballpark. That would be, 10 parts per million, in that order. Maybe it's 100 parts per million, but it's not going to be a big shift. If you were using that variable capacitor to tune in a radio station, would you now go from CBS over to NBC? No way. Let me drop. In the case of an AM or an FM radio, and you put it into a vacuum chamber, the amount of retuning is going to be so minor that you're not going to hear any difference coming out of that hi-fi radio. But with a frequency counter, you will measure it. So, yes, there is a factor there. And now, where is the energy stored in a capacitor? Is a very interesting question. Is it stored by an excess of electrons on one plate and a lack of electrons on the other plate? Or is it stored as to something that goes on in the dielectric material? In the case of that air variable capacitor, if I found out that the spacing between the plates of the air variable capacitor is 10 thousandths of an inch, and if I pick up a whole bunch of pieces of plastic that have a dielectric constant of 3, and each of my sheets of plastic are 10 thousandths of an inch thick, and I cut them up in just the right shape, and now I start squeezing those pieces of plastic in between the air spaces of this air variable capacitor, will I tune it to a lower frequency? Absolutely. You could, with that technique, without rotating the air variable capacitor, by putting sheets of plastic in there, you could do two or three things simultaneously. Number one, you could tune it to a lower frequency. Number two, you would increase the dielectric strength in some cases. I had an air variable capacitor on my 300-watt, 6-meter transmitter, made out of a 4CX250B transmitter. And occasionally that the tuning and loading control capacitor, the tuning capacitor on the Pi output network, occasionally it would arc over. And what I did was to put sheets of Teflon in between the spaces of the air variable capacitor. And I made another discovery when I did that. Let me drop. I found out that there is Teflon, and there's Teflon. If you have true virgin Teflon, and you put it in there, no problem. If you use recycled Teflon, and you put those sheets of Teflon in a capacitor that used to arc over occasionally in air, now it's going to arc over more frequently. And you'll say, what in the world is going on? Well, you take that recycled Teflon and look at it under a microscope, and you find out it's got some very fine pinholes in it. And the air finds a way to go through those pinholes and arc through again. So the first time I did it, I was using recycled Teflon, and I didn't get an improvement. I couldn't understand that. Somebody told me about this pinhole problem with Teflon. I went and got some good Teflon, and the problem went away. So you can increase the dielectric strength, the high voltage characteristics of your air variable capacitor, by putting the right kind of plastic in there. And yes, you can change the tuning a little bit by doing that. Fun type stuff. Another science experiment there, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the tech net.
Well, it seems like this guy was on the right track. He made that assumption, and it looks like he's correct. But of course, if you, like you said, if you put a transistor radio in a belt jar and evacuate it, you're not going to change the station. But you could measure it with a frequency counter. That's good to know. And maybe that's something to control. All right, let me let it drop. On to the next one.
Well, let's pick up Doug, who just made a comment. WA2SAY, K2RIW.
Ian, to extend, you still didn't explain how the dielectric changed the capacitor. We did it with C, which is the capacitor, or XC, in the impedance value. Enter here.
Hi, Dick, WA2SAY. I just wanted to make electric constant of air and space, for that matter, is very close to being 1.00. And I just want to make sure that everybody understands that. Go ahead, Dick.
Well, we know that. My understanding is how the C is changed.
Yes. The so-called E sub zero, the basic dielectric number for a vacuum, is well documented. I don't know it right now. That's got a 4 pi in there, as I remember. Anyhow, and I may be confusing permittivity of vacuum versus permeability of vacuum. But when we talk about dielectric constant, we're talking about something that really isn't constant. In other words, if I rated the dielectric constant of FR4 board, I might find out that at 100 megacycles it is 3.5, and at 1,000 megacycles it is 3.8. I might find that. So the so-called dielectric constant really means how many times higher in capacitance will you have if you first start off with two plates that are in a vacuum, and then you put the unknown substance in there. As you place the unknown substance between the two plates and completely fill up that vacuum space, the amount of capacitance in picofarads or microfarads is going to increase. The ratio by which it increases, we call it dielectric constant, even though it's a slight variable as a function of frequency and function of lot number of the FR4 and a bunch of other variable characteristics. Let me drop. And what Wesley is asking is...
You're still not explaining why it changes. Go to the molecular structure. Or go to the electrostatic properties.
Yeah, I was starting to explain that when I got interrupted. The electrons going around the nucleus of each individual atom of your dielectric material get disturbed in a certain way when there is an externally applied electrostatic field. When I start putting voltage on those two plates of the capacitor, and I'm creating some number of volts across some distance, which we usually rate in volts per meter, or volts per inch, or volts per thousandth of an inch, you are disturbing the electrons that are going around that nucleus of that material, and that disturbance, you're storing energy, believe it or not. You're storing energy in the way you disturb the individual molecules and those orbits of the electrons going around. And so each material has its own characteristic as to how much energy you store. And so one of the experiments that you can do with a so-called Leyden jar, and I've done this one, where you take this thing that you can buy from some of these science laboratories, which really is two metal cups, one inside of the other, with a piece of plastic in between the two. And so you charge this with your Wimshurst machine at 100,000 volts, we'll say, and you now take the inner metal cup away from the outer metal cup, You separated the two. And you also pick up the piece of plastic that was in between the two as the spacer, and you take that out of the outer cup. And you lay the three components on the table. And you go and test the inner cup, the outer cup, and you do some reasonable testing on the piece of plastic.